I was asked this week to comment for some reason on autopsies. I don't know why. I don't think it was in the news. But it's a subject, it's a topic, and I try to teach on where your heads may be. So if everyone's thinking about autopsies, let's speak about autopsies. Autopsies. What could be the... There's three potential halakhic problems with autopsies. The first problem is that we have a prohibition after a body dies not to in any way disenfranchise it, not in any way changing it. For example, you can ask at a local funeral homes what happens when they do an open casket. And sometimes, you know, when you die, the hands are no longer in control. So a hand can go this way, or a hand can go that way. What do to straighten it out? They say they break it. They just go, oh, and it breaks. And this way, it's like this, right? We're not allowed to do that. We can't in any way break any bones, God forbid. We can't in any way leave. We have to leave the body intact and bury it intact. So the first prohibition is, if you're going to do an autopsy, you're changing the body around. After death, that's a prohibition. The second prohibition is that after a person dies, you're not supposed to benefit from their body. Now, what do I mean benefit from their body? First of all, sometimes the body wears various ornaments, a ring, a golden tooth, certain things you can sell for money. People are sick out there. In the Gemara, there was a very famous thing. If you wanted a carpet, apparently it wasn't so common, you took the hair off the body, you made a carpet. So people would shave the hair off a body and use it to make a nice rug. So these are the benefits. Well, but let's say today, a more contemporary example. You know, you want to get rid of your Jewish nose. A guy dies with a nice nose. You want to get rid of your nose. He doesn't have such a Jewish nose. You take off his nose, you put it on yourself. I don't think it makes you less Jewish. No, not a lot of benefit from the body. The third problem is, which is probably a minor problem in this instance, is the fact that we have an obligation to bury the body when? As soon as possible, within a day. So ultimately, you're going to do an autopsy, that's going to prolong it, maybe, but maybe not. Maybe you can do it within a day. Those are the three potential issues. Now, gentlemen, why would you do an autopsy? Okay, what's the two main reasons? You are trying to do what? To save another life, to make a long story short. How are you going to save another life? In a various ways. First of all, you take out the bullets from the body, you can match it up with someone's gun, that killer won't kill more people. Hopefully you'll get him, you put him behind bars where he or she belongs. Secondly, more importantly, medical research. You want to save a life, right? So if this guy died in some way or another, and by doing an operation after the person died, you can find out the reason for that death, you could potentially save other lives later. Strange circumstances to the death, yes? So again, that's a medical reason of a medical examiner coming along and saying, we need to know why, because we want to prevent this in the future. This body's dead already. Nothing we can do for it, right? But another body, God forbid, a 15-year-old is walking the streets today and drop dead. We want to save that 15-year-old by doing an autopsy. So that's the first reason, namely medical research to save future lives. There's another reason that I think we're overlooking, though. And that reason is what? Another reason is very simple. Medical training. Medical training. You want to be a surgeon. You have to practice. I don't think it's a good idea to practice on live bodies. If you make a mistake, that could be a pretty bad mistake. If a person, for example, was in the wrong blood, that could be a bad mistake. I had a guy who was the contractor of my parents' home in Israel. Right? 38-year-old man, healthy as you wouldn't believe, went into the hospital for a very simple procedure. I think he had tonsils out, something like that. He died in an operating table. Well, zook, zook, they put him on the wrong blood. What could you do? What could you do? So if you have a surgeon or a potential surgeon practicing on a live body, mistakes can be detrimental. You have a surgeon practicing on a body that's already dead, the worst that can happen is he makes a mistake. So future medical direction, in the sense that you're trying to train future doctors. Now Joey has a point.
Yeah, but when you have a situation of...
Okay.
You know, because...
So if it's to determine the cause of death that won't save future lives, that's a different category. And I want to speak about that now. Yeah. Okay, so organ transplant after death has the same problems as I just presented, the same idea. You're changing the body and the same idea. However, it's not a new issue, I must admit. There was times in the Gemara that they wanted to do certain tests after death. I'm going to read you a story right now about it. But there's no question that autopsy is the way we do it today, right? Pathology and whatever it is, it's obviously new. And Torah, that's the beauty of Torah. You apply it to every generation. You take the ancient laws and you apply it to every new scenario, including the electric shaver, the automatic elevator, and many other issues that came up in the last few years. That's the beauty of Jewish law. Now I'm just going to read you the story, and next week we'll pick up on this. Let's read the story about how what happened once. This is the absolute source for not doing an autopsy, because you're going to change the body. You're going to disrespect it by doing a thing. I read to you word for word. I'm translating, of course, from Hebrew. This is the Gemara, Tractate Baba Batra, which deals mainly with monetary law, so it's funny to find it there. Page 154a, bottom of the page. And this was the story in Bnei Brak. Anyone know Bnei Brak today? Okay. Anytime they try to say Halifax doesn't get to the fingertips of Bnei Brak or the footsteps, you quote to them this story, they'll be embarrassed to say they're in Bnei Brak. You ready for this? Okay, this is the story in Bnei Brak about someone that sold his father's estate and he died. And his grandchildren came, his other kids, other family members came, and said, hey, when he sold it, he was underage. Well, what's the law in Jewish law? If you sell something and you're underage? The sale is null and void, it's absolutely meaningless. Right? He was underage. So of course the family's saying, no, he wasn't underage. If he was underage, what's going to be the story now? The sale is null and void. They get back to estate. They are now the what? The beneficiaries or the inheritors, and they get to estate. Well, the family, of course, said, no, the people that have this, they say, hey, he was over 13 or whatever, he was above 13, and they say he was under 13. How are they going to reconcile it? So they come before Rabbi Akiva. We all know who Rabbi Akiva was. It's not the time to go into it. And they say to Rabbi Akiva, can we check the body? Namely, we'll check if the body is matured enough, that is obviously an older person, then great. And if not, not. What do they check for? It's a good question. What exactly they're checking for? It could be pubic hair. It could be many different things. He said to them, you can't do it. You can't do it because there's an issur of nivul. You are going ahead and you're changing the body. And he said, he gave another reason. The fact of the matter is, after death, the body can change totally. You never know what happens after death. Your test wouldn't be an authentic test. Now, from this Gemara, many imply that maybe it's not such a prohibition. You know, yes, it's a prohibition, but let's say that they could do an authentic test after death. They can find out exactly how old he is through DNA. Just giving a theoretical. Maybe he would have allowed it. He seemed to give two reasons. One of the reasons is not relevant today. Maybe it would be allowed in certain scenarios. Is there situations where Jewish law will say the three prohibitions that I just mentioned, namely burying right away, which we can take care of easily, secondly, not in any way changing the body, and thirdly, not getting any benefit from the body, is there situations where all these prohibitions are turned away for some sake or another? And this Gemara, what is the big issue? Not saving a life, not medical research. What's the issue?
Money.
Money. For financial gain. For financial reasons, it seems like you can push away, or potentially push away, these prohibitions. We ended off by quoting three Talmudic sources that seem to suggest that there's three various prohibitions involved in autopsies. If a person wanted to do an autopsy for whatever reason, and we explained that the two main reasons today to do an autopsy is, first of all, for future medical research. You might be able to save potential lives in or if indeed you did an autopsy. And secondly, for present medical training. Obviously, it's much healthier for a doctor to train on a body that's no longer alive than to train on a body that is alive. So for those two reasons, it's no question that autopsies are done today in the medical profession. It explains the three prohibitions that are potentially involved. What are they? Going over them quickly. First of all, you're not supposed to delay a funeral. If you delay the organ from being buried, this might be a problem. But we do have a 24-hour period. Autopsies are usually not put off too long, so let's assume we're able to get around that. Secondly, there's a prohibition to have any benefit from a dead body. And the third prohibition that's involved is, of course, in any way disenfranchising, ruining the body. Now, obviously, the Talmud, we read that story, we explained that they wanted to open up the grave and do a sort of an autopsy on a body for financial gain. But, as the Talmud said, it was prohibited. But that basically opened up a certain avenue to say maybe it would not be prohibited in all situations. The fact that they suggested it means that maybe you're allowed to do an autopsy in certain situations. So where would we find this issue coming up? Transplant, but if you wanted to look at it, at Jewish law, if you wanted to look in Jewish law and try to find the source, where would you go?
Sure.
To the response of literature. Namely, literature in which rabbis were given questions and they wrote answers. And eventually they compiled them in a book. Now, interestingly, there was no Xerox at these times. So how would they eventually publish them? Two ways. One way was they'd ask the person that they sent it to, when you get the answer, send it back so I can publish it in my book. The second way was, you know, take a guess. There's no Xerox, but you actually copied it twice. Yeah, You copied it twice. This was done even recently before Xerox machines came out. So anyway, one of the first people that deals with this, a very known person, is the Noda BeYehuda. He wrote a response to literature. He called it Noda BeYehuda. Obviously, his name wasn't Noda BeYehuda. What was his name? Rabbi Yecheskel Landa. A word about Rabbi Yecheskel Landa. Rabbi Yecheskel Landa was basically a rabbi during the year 1713 to 1793. Rabbi Yecheskel Landa was a rabbi mainly in Prague. Everybody here, a few people here have been to Prague, no? No one? All right, ask Darrell Pink. He's been to Prague. He'll tell you all about Prague. Beautiful Jewish city. Have amazing rabbis there. That's basically where he functioned. The year 1713 to 1793. I'm sure when he was 3 years old, he didn't yet function. But by the time he was 20, he began to answer halakhic questions, halakhic inquiries, and they were included in his book. And what does he write? I read, regarding the query you sent me that included a question sent to you from the Jewish community in London. This, of course, tells us what? That during the year, first of all, they talked to each other. Second of all, they definitely hold them in great esteem that they didn't ask their local rabbi, they went to a rabbi in Prague. And thirdly, there was a Jewish community during the years that the Noda BeYehuda functioned in London. So, what was the question? Concerning an incident that occurred there involving a patient suffering from gallstones, whose doctors performed surgery following common medical practice, but the surgery was unsuccessful and he died. The halachic authorities of the city were asked whether it was permissible to dissect the corpse in that area in order to obtain a clear view of the source of the disease. Okay? Very simple question. We want, again, future medical research. Can we do an autopsy? The answer he gave was a very, I would say, traditional answer. What was his answer? Look, there's prohibitions in the Torah, correct? What overrides them? Health. To be more precise, sharpening it. Not health in the sense that you have a headache, you need to violate Shabbos, but rather life. Namely, what we call in Jewish law a life-threatening situation. Right? Ultimately, in a life-threatening situation, that totally absolves all Jewish law. And he answers very traditionally, look, is there a life-threatening situation involved right now? And by doing the autopsy, you'd be able to gain research and knowledge to save a life. And he therefore gives a very, very clear fundamental rule. If you have another patient right now with gallstones, and this patient, you don't know how to cure them, and you might be able to gain research from doing an autopsy, life-threatening situations overrides all Jewish law, including the three prohibitions we have mentioned, and therefore you can do the autopsy. If you don't have a clear and present life-threatening situation that you could potentially heal, autopsies are forbidden. And as everybody could see, you don't need a genius to say to you this, this is Jewish law, right? You're allowed to violate Shabbos. No. Let's say I'm in a life-threatening situation. Yes. That's basically what he's saying. But what's his insight? His insight is that you may or may not gain medical knowledge. Sometimes you do an autopsy, you come up empty-handed. Correct? So therefore, that's the case. It's not exactly a situation where it's absolutely sure that if you violate these prohibitions, you will gain medical knowledge. However, we all know, even in a doubt, don't take chances. A person might be in a life-threatening situation or may not. What are you going to do? Sit there and start doing probabilities and statistics? You take him to the hospital. Obviously. You don't take out your fraction book at that point. So he says, if there is a chance, but for a clear situation, then okay. In the same realm, in the same way of thinking, went his future son-in-law, the Chatam Sofer. The Chatam Sofer, very known rabbi, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, his years is, I actually wrote it down for myself here, his years are 1762 to 1839, much more contemporary. And he says, just like the Noda BeYehuda, that if indeed there's a clear and present way to save a life, you can do an autopsy. If it's not clear and present, namely it might happen, there might be another sickness like this, that is not enough grounds to do an autopsy. These are their positions. Now, what about the Chatam Sofer? Rabbi Moshe Sofer was born in a place that every Jew that was born there was very proud of it. I'll tell you why. It was called Frankfurt on the Main. Everybody here knows there's two Frankfurts in Germany, right? You didn't know that? There's two Frankfurts. Whoever was born in Frankfurt on the Main made sure to tell you that. And they always signed, my name is Rabbi Moshe from Frankfurt on the Main. They were extremely proud of it because the other Frankfurt apparently were a little bit more low-life degenerates. wanted to make it clear. Ha, we're not from there. He was a rabbi there. He eventually was a rabbi in a place called Pressburg. And very, very known. To tell you is, there's certain rabbis that function at a certain time. They passed on. And you read about them in the history books. Other rabbis, their influence continues to this very day. Give me an example of one that lived many, many years ago in the Middle Ages, but no rabbi can get away without quoting him. Maimonides, right? Very good. Thank you for guessing. Maimonides. Who doesn't quote Maimonides? Who doesn't speak about Maimonides, the great doctor, the great halachic word, the one who took the Jewish law and made it into a textbook? There's no question his influence continues to this very day. There's still books written about him. Another example is the Chatam Sofer. There's no question his influence continues to this day, for better or for worse. So to sum up, Elder Yehuda comes out and says, you have a clear and present situation. You have a cancer patient, and this person died of cancer. You can gain knowledge for that patient. Not for a potential patient, but for a patient that's in the hospital, or for a potential patient that's on your patient list. He's on your charts. You can do an autopsy. A potential? A potential is not good enough. You can't do an autopsy. That was their opinion. I'll just add one addendum, and then I'll take your questions. Today, in the global village we live in, with internet and with emails, it might very well be that according to the Nodibi Yehuda and the Chatham Sofer, having someone before you is not physically before you, but somewhere in the world. If you're all on a network of some sort, and doctors do have a case, an extraordinary case somewhere, and there's another person that's dying of it somewhere else, that could very well be, according to these opinions, before you. Not necessarily literally, as it was in their time, but rather even globally because of the way we interact today in terms of networking. Yeah?
What about an unusual death?
An unusual death.
And for, say, a very young person.
Yeah. So again, according to the Chatham Sofer, if there's an unusual death that happened, and there's an unusual death that's about to happen somewhere in the world, that's not grounds enough to do an autopsy, according to their opinion. Not their opinion. We're going to introduce another view tonight, but that's their opinion, okay?
Yes, on the same principle of the Kuav method of the Shabbat.
Yes, and we exactly the same principle. He says very clearly, there's three prohibitions. What overrides prohibitions? Life-threatening situation. You have it, you overrided the prohibitions. You don't have it, you potentially have it, you may have it. That's not grounds enough. That's their opinion. There's no question that they both agree on this point. God willing, we're going to introduce another view. Second opinion comes a little later in history, I must say a little later in history, and from a person that's not as known as the Chatham Sofer and the people we spoke about, and yet an opinion that is quoted again. I would like to introduce you tonight to a second rabbi that dealt with the issue, Rabbi Yaakov Etlinger, known to some as the Aruch Laner and to others as the Binyan Sion, depends which book you're familiar with. First of all, an amazing writer. Second of all, he functioned in the year 1792 to 1831. Namely, the ghetto has already been broken. Jews are already involved in other professions other than the traditional professions within the ghetto. And he deals with many of the issues that pertain to that. For example, we find for one of the first times the issue of mixed dancing in his particular answer.
What?
Mixed dancing, men and women together, mixed dancing. So many of these questions, new questions that came up throughout history, come and begins at that around that time. He was a rabbi in a place called Altoona. I don't know exactly where that is, but it's definitely in the Austrian-Hungarian Empire at that time, Germany, Poland. We don't know exactly where because it went back and forth so many times. And ultimately, he deals with this question and disagrees totally with everything we just said. What does he write? And I quote, I was asked about a sick person with a terrible disease, maybe what Laurie spoke about, namely someone with an extraordinary disease. And the doctor tried to cure him to no avail, for he died of his illness. And there is another sick person who has this same disease, and the doctors wish to perform an autopsy to study the disease so that they may find a cure for the one that's still alive. Is it permissible to discover, to disfigure the corpse or not? Our question, right? Exactly what the Nodeb Yehuda, the Chatham Sofer, allowed? His opinion is nada. Why? He says, with all due respect, you don't know if you're going to save him. Let's face it, you can open up a corpse. You won't gain any knowledge from it. You just won't know. You open it up, nowadays very commonly, to find out the cause of death. You won't find a conclusive cause of death. What can you do? There's no, it's not a black box of an airplane where you happen to open it up and know exactly what happened. It's a body, no longer functioning. And he writes the following, and I quote, how can we say that based on pikuach nefesh, or endangering a life, a sick person may disgrace and discover a corpse, for presumably the deceased does not waive his disgrace? He says, with regard to the prohibitions, it's very nice, but there's one problem. What were the three prohibitions involved in autopsy? Delaying the funeral, getting benefit from the body, and disgracing the body. For the first two, he said, you can find solutions. You could say you're not delaying the funeral, and with all due respect, you're not benefiting from the body, you're not taking off a piece of hair, you're not taking off a nose to make yourself a non-Jewish nose. You're just gaining knowledge from the body. But with regard to disgracing the body, you got to ask the dead person if he minds. Well, I give you the challenge. Yaakov, go ask the dead person if he minds. If he answers, you know he's not dead. If he doesn't answer, you know he's dead, but you're still stuck. And therefore, he ends by saying that this is absolutely forbidden, and the saving life through it is uncertain. And that uncertainty doesn't allow it, and he ends off by saying, and I quote, it's preferable to do what's called in halachic Hebrew, shev va'al ta'aseh, in English, sit back and do nothing. In other words, he says, it's forbidden, you cannot override the prohibition of disgrace based on an uncertainty, a doubt that you might be able to possibly save a life later. If that's not certain, you cannot override it, and therefore his opinion was very clearly no. Yes?
What about prior consent, such as people advising in advance how they wish to be handled in death, and that would avoid their condition?
So that would be an interesting question. What happens if, for example, he has a donor's card today? Or he has one of the means that allow us to disgrace his body, basically. Does that allow us to do it? And of course, according to the very simple reading of Rabbi Finkler, he might indeed say, yeah, no problem. He also brings up another point, though, which is very important, and that is that he brings up a very common halachic issue in Tractate Baba Kama, page 60, that deals with, can you save someone else through yourself? Put yourself in danger for someone else. Very interesting issue. We can't go into it now. And it says very simply, you cannot save someone else with the money of another person. It says explicitly in the Gemara, if I could save you by stealing money, I can't do it. Right? I can't say, oh, we should definitely contribute to this cause. I pledge $500 from Victor's account. You can't do that. Everybody understands why. So he says very similarly, let's apply it to this situation. You're trying to save another life with this body. Can't do it. And that's Rav Efflinger's decision. That's what he decided. There's no question that in his area where he functioned, this question came up, and he absolutely said no. However, you should know that of all the opinions that we've quoted, his opinion is not widely accepted. And we're going to see why more in detail, but I'll just tell you tonight one little caveat. Rav Uziel. Everybody here ever heard of Rav Uziel, more contemporary than Aruch HaMeir? Rav Uziel, Rav Meir Chai Uziel, was the first chief rabbi of Palestine. Not of Israel, he functioned before the founding of the state. Actually, no, maybe not. Was he alive in 1948? I'm not sure, I didn't check his lineage. Rav Kook died in 35. He was together with Rav Kook. There was a Turkish law in Israel that you have to have a Chacham Bashi, which means a Sephardic chief rabbi and Ashkenazic chief rabbi. I'm not sure. He definitely was the first chief rabbi together with Rav Kook. I don't know how long afterwards. But Meir Chai Uziel, who was the chief rabbi, I'm pretty sure during the founding of the State of Israel, he counters and says the following, and I quote. He says, a person is only forbidden to save himself with someone else's money when there's no other way to save himself. When there's no, right? I mean, there's other ways. But when there's no alternative, he's permitted to save himself with someone else's money. The Gemara was talking about a situation where you could save him through someone else's money, or maybe there's other means. The Gemara says, look for other means. Don't steal. Don't be a thief. But when there's no other means, that's the way it is. What can we do with all medical research today? There's no other means to save a person except through this autopsy. If that's the situation, he feels that that's not applicable. And as I said, the Aruch HaMeir was not widely accepted, and this goes on and on throughout Jewish history. And we're going to see God warning the middle approach of someone that functioned a little later, but his influence, like the Chatham Sofer, continues to this day, especially on Israeli soil, the Chazon Ish. We will deal with the Chazon Ish, who he was. All I could say is, of the rabbis that functioned, he died in 1953. He is as alive today for certain communities in the year 2005. Tonight we're going to see a third opinion, and that is of the Chazon Ish. I don't have to tell some people in the world who the Chazon Ish is. You know why? His influence continues to this very day in certain communities, as if he's still alive. What he did ultimately continued past his own tenure. I'll just give you one very simple example. In 1948, what happened? May 14th, 1948, you couldn't buy a Jew for $1 million. The State of Israel was founded, correct? Very good. On that very day, we have a very interesting problem in Israel. do you have one army or a few armies in Israel? What did you have pre-1948? Different undergrounds. You had the Haganah, you had the Hetzel, you had the Lechi, and you had something called the Plugot Datiot, the religious battalions. They were religious soldiers all in one battalion. After the state is founded, Ben Gurion makes the famous speech in the Knesset in which he says, we're going to find one army in which every soldier on his chagor, on his belt that carries his canteens and his magazines, he'll also have room for a tefillin if he chooses to wear it. And ultimately, what you have today in the Israeli army is what? A kosher army, doesn't desecrate Shabbos, an amazing miracle that we're seeing. Well, what we call, in popular language, the ultra-Orthodox, I don't like that term, they had a big problem. They don't know if they're going to go into the army or not, and they basically decide, after long deliberations, we're going to give exemptions to certain people learning in yeshivas. Who does Ben-Gurion strike to deal with? The Chazon Ish. Now you understand how much his influence continues to this very day. How many soldiers in Israel, potential soldiers, don't go to the army because of the Chazon Ish? That's how strong his influence is. The Chazon Ish on this issue says, the Noldei B'Yehuda, I agree with him, but I disagree a little bit. He says, when can you do an autopsy? When you have a common sickness. And this person died of a common sickness, and doing an autopsy can add information about a common sickness. However, if it's so uncommon, that what's the probability of another person coming in with the same sickness? Low. Then you can't do an autopsy. So he changes it a little bit. Another of you spoke about a person in front of us, a live person that's sick. He speaks about the case being common or not common. Ultimately, if it's a common sickness and you have sufficient grounds that another person's going to come in, you can do an autopsy. You can override these three prohibitions because you're going to save a life. If it's not common, ultimately, you can't. Now, of course, Jason's looking at me and saying, well, what's the statistics over here? You know, I'm a doctor of mathematics. What exactly is common and not? Obviously, here you have to ask the medical professionals, what's a common sickness today in terms of the world of cancer, in terms of the world of Alzheimer's, and many other different realms of sicknesses, unfortunately. You have to, of course, ask the doctor what they consider common or not. But that's his opinion. And as a very important addendum, I'm just going to say, start seeing opinions that allow autopsies almost clear-cut. Almost clear-cut. I say almost because nobody allows it. Just you do autopsies anytime you want. But definitely much more lenient than what we've seen until now. If it's common, the Chazon Ish says you can do it. If it's uncommon, you can't. Until now, we've seen three different opinions on it, but all opinions were basically saying you do not allow it except for very explicit circumstances. I have to admit that tonight we're going to continue on the same path. No one just allows you to do autopsies anytime because it does have three prohibitions involved, namely disfiguring the corpse, secondly, causing the burial to be delayed, and thirdly, gaining benefit from a dead body, all those prohibitions. And yet tonight we're going to see a much more lenient approach. And we're going to basically combine a few different views that basically say the same thing. Historically, we're going to start with a guy called the Shaul Meshach. Very important figure, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th, the Shaul Meshach, the Reish Lakish. He basically says, based on the Gemara we quoted from Bnei Brak. What happened in Bnei Brak, if you remember, they wanted to dig up the body to see if the kid who was the inheritor to the estate was a kid when he sold it. If he was a kid, then all the sales are null and void, and the rest of the inheritors get it. If he wasn't a kid, then his sale indeed is valid. And the Gemara says, what are you, crazy? You're going to do an autopsy for financial gain? Based on this, the Shaul Meshach says, it's not that it's forbidden to do an autopsy because you're disfiguring the body. Rather, it's forbidden to do it for no reason. And the reason, the Gemara, with all due respect, is not a good enough reason. If you have a good reason, you can do an autopsy. And he basically says, saving another potential life, even if it's potential, even if it's not necessarily going to happen. What can you do? A guy just died. His particular body doesn't have the remedy for that particular sickness. Still, a very good chance, a very worthy cause. In a very similar vein, Rav Uziel. I already told you who Rav Uziel was, the first Sephardi chief rabbi of Palestine and then Israel. He basically says, very explicitly, on the one hand, there's no such thing as a blanket heter or a blanket leniency here. We're talking about prohibitions. But he does say something very interesting, and I do quote, in a case like ours, if they do not perform an autopsy on this body because of the prohibition, they will never perform an autopsy. In other words, if you come out and say autopsy is not bound, then doctors won't do it. And he continues. This knowledge, namely the knowledge in a potential body to save another life, will then always be hidden from us. After all, you're going to bury this body in a few minutes, right? And this will certainly lead to death of a number of people. And he basically comes out and says an autopsy can be done for medical reasons to gain medical research. Now, interesting, these two views are dealing mainly with one of the reasons for autopsies, and that, of course, is to save potential lives, for medicine. What they're not dealing with is the second reason for autopsies, and what's that? No. That no one allows, I must agree. Nobody allows to find the cause of death. They want to find how they can save other people. The cause of death might be that. But to be more precise, why do you do an autopsy today? Either to gain medical knowledge or for medical training. You have a surgeon practice on a body as opposed to practicing on a live body. So ultimately, no one talks about medical training, and indeed nobody, as far as I've seen, talks about it, and therefore I assume no one allows it. But interestingly, the Tzitz Eliezer has a very important distinction. I think he sums it up very nicely. Who's the Tzitz Eliezer, first of all? Is he still alive? Do you know what the hell if he's still alive? He might even still be alive. We're in the year 2005 tonight, for the tape I'm telling that. And ultimately, he could still be alive. He must be an old man already today. The Tzitz Eliezer is one of the biggest deciders of laws, knows the poskim, in the land of Israel that Israel has ever seen. The man wrote endless volumes, but his most important job was he was the decider in Jewish law for a very important hospital in Jerusalem, Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. I just want to introduce you to this hospital. If you're ever in Israel, take a look. Go to that hospital on Shabbos. If you're going to be in Jerusalem for Shabbos, Friday night, go to the Kotel, eat a good meal, and then take a spazier to Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. This hospital was built in a certain way that ultimately everything is done according to Jewish law. They solved all halachic issues. They don't rely on any opinion. They do it medically correct, and they do it in such a way that if a doctor comes in, he doesn't violate Jewish law. I'll give you a simple example. A doctor does rounds in Shabbos, correct? Saving lives. You have to write down something in the chart. What does he have with him in Shaarei Tzedek Hospital? A non-Jewish Arab or Filipino that writes it for him. He dictates, she writes it.
Or a pen, which will...
Yeah, that wasn't their invention, though. I have to be correct.
Okay.
The invention of a pen that has an ink that disappears after a day, that's of Machon Solman, near where I used to live.
And then they photocopy it
after Shabbos, and then the ink eventually appears, and that's a rabbinic prohibition. They have solved every issue. From the Shabbos elevator, which is a simple one, to I'll give you something nicely. Can you put a cap on a bottle on Shabbos? In these hospitals in Israel, they have formula for the babies that come in a bottle, and you take off the cover, and you put on a cap at the bottom that the baby can suck from. Can you put a cap on Shabbos? It might be considered building on Shabbos. It might not be. They take the stringent approach. You come in, you ask for a bottle, the non-Jewish lady puts it on for you. That's Shaarei Tzedek Hospital. You have to see it to believe it. I was privileged to be there when no one was born for Shabbos. I have never seen the laws of Shabbos come alive so vividly than that week. I learned so much. That one little Shabbos taught me everything I need to know about hospitals, medicine, and Shabbos. It was an amazing experience. The decider of law for this hospital was the Tzitz Eliezer. He wrote endless volumes, mainly on medical ethics as well. And he writes very simply, for the sake of pathology, to know the cause of death, no way, he says. But we should allow an autopsy if the deceased died for some illness and we still do not fully understand that we can cure it. He allows it. He does not allow to delay the burial for days and days, meaning leave the body there. Rather, an autopsy should be done right away because you can't delay the burial, especially, by the way, in the city of Jerusalem. I don't know if you guys know this, but the hardest law I have as a rabbi is to explain to people how we're not going to delay the funeral. It has to be done within 24 hours. But in the land, if you live in Jerusalem, the rabbis have a harder job for two reasons. First of all, in Jerusalem, there's a custom that you don't delay the funeral at all. The body dies, within 2-3 hours, is in the ground. So what happens if the body dies in Shabbos? You can't bury. When do they bury?
Shabbos.
Saturday night. Shabbos goes out the latest in Israel, 8:30. Much easier than Halifax. When do they bury? 10:30, 11:30, 12:30, whatever it is. They don't delay funerals in Jerusalem. There's another crazy custom in Jerusalem, and that is the kids don't go to the funeral. They come to the procession, they come to the funeral, let's say, in the funeral home, but they don't go after the body, they don't go to the burial. I don't know where this custom comes from. I never understood it. But anyway, back here. Gentlemen, the city of Jerusalem, a body dies, you bury it, and outside of Israel, the same law applies. You bury it as soon as possible. not as rigorous as Jerusalem, but you bury as soon as possible. Gentlemen, he says you can't leave a body there for days for medical training. You're doing it to save a life. But we see here three views that are much more into if a doctor says they need it for medical research, you can allow them to do an autopsy. Not delay the funeral, but to do an autopsy. They do not allow it for psychological reasons, namely, what's the cause of death? Let's say someone just died, and doctor says, listen, I don't need this for my medical research, right?
Just to find out
historically how a person died, like he was poisoned, but you want to know which poison killed him just for the record, that's not something that I've seen that's allowed. To go ahead and do it because you want to gain more insights as to what poison can be poisonous for the body, that would be okay. So ultimately, according to these views, if a doctor comes and says, I need to do an autopsy for medical research, not because there was a crime done and we need to establish the cause, in the sense of the person overdosed themselves, you want to know exactly how much overdose they took, that's not allowed. However, I did state that if you're doing an autopsy in order to find out who the killer was, I think that is saving a life. This killer could be roaming the streets right now. You have to get him as soon as possible. I want to end off this evening with Rav Goren. Rav Goren, as you all know, I don't know if you heard of Rav Goren, but if you've seen the famous picture of the Six-Day War when they come back to Jerusalem, to the old city, to the Kotel, have you seen the picture? Neil, have you seen it?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
You haven't seen it? Oh, my God, Leo, you have an absolute problem. There's something missing. You got to go home tonight on the internet. Look for the picture. You'll see that picture. Soldiers looking at the wall with a little rabbi there with a beard, nice trimmed beard, okay? A funny cap, a chauffeur, and a Torah scroll. Rav Shlomo Goren. The man was born outside of Israel. His parents make Aliyah. His name was Gorenchik. They changed it to Goren. Because in Israel, that was the fashion then. Everyone made their name into a more Israeli name. Rav Gorenchik became Goren, learned in the Hebron Yeshiva. The man was an absolute amazing mind. An amazing mind. The only problem with an amazing mind sometimes is that you feel so sure about yourself, which is good and not good. He had some amazing, innovative ideas that were not accepted, and he was basically never consulting anyone. He was sure of himself. That could be a disadvantage, and it could be a disadvantage. It depends how you look at it. When he was the chief rabbi of the Israeli army, it's the best thing in the world. Because in the Israeli army, if anyone ever mixed meat and milk in any kitchen, they know he'd have him on trial the next day. Because he didn't talk to anyone. He was there, he was a general. So he's a rabbi, but a general. So what did he do? That helicopter went right to the base, got the guy, took him by the neck, court-martialed and put him into jail for mixing meat and milk. When he became a civilian, he became the chief rabbi of Israel in 1973. Oh my gosh, when you teach with civilians, you can't talk that way. And ultimately, that's who he was. But an amazing mind. He writes, but you have to take one more thing into consideration on this issue, and that is the issue of a national policy. Until now, we're speaking about an autopsy being done in Halifax to a Jew, which is part of the population. In Israel, everyone's Jewish, correct? So if you're going to make a policy, no autopsies, the state won't have medical knowledge needed. And he definitely brings that in as a very important aspect in this whole debate, that ultimately, nationally, there's much more of a need in the state of Israel, simply because everybody is Jewish. And if you totally say no autopsies, you won't have the right general medical knowledge. And Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, who was the last big German scholar of the famous Hildesheimers in Germany, he basically writes the same thing approximately in the Sri Deish. But as you could see, there's a various views with regard to how much can you allow. Nobody, however, gives a blanket leniency. You can always allow autopsies. It's no problem. The body is dead. Who cares anymore? He doesn't feel a thing. That does not happen. We believe if a body housed a soul, ultimately that body is holy and you have to treat it with dignity. As a matter of fact, one of the authorities make a claim that if the reason we don't disfigure a corpse is because there used to be a soul there, then what better way of disfiguring a corpse than to save another soul, to save another Jew, to save another non-Jew, whatever it might be, by doing an autopsy. But dignity must be retained. You don't allow autopsies just for nothing. You allow it in certain situations to save other lives. The general, I would say, summary on this particular issue, applying the ancient laws of the Torah to the new reality of autopsies, is as follows. A, you can't do an autopsy. It violates three prohibitions in the Torah. Prohibition number one, disfiguring the corpse. Prohibition number two, gaining benefit from the corpse. And prohibition number three, in some cases, of course, delaying the funeral. That's the line. Secondly, however, everybody here knows that there's one thing that overrides the entire Torah. And what's that? Saving a life. And there's no question, as we saw throughout the week, in order to gain medical research, there's no question that autopsies are sometimes needed. So you know not so much about how this guy passed away, which is a psychological knowledge that may or may not come out of an autopsy, but definitely doesn't warrant an autopsy. However, this person's body may contain information to save someone that's living. And I can put it into context, as one of the authorities said, why is it that we don't disfigure a corpse? Why is it that when other religions do an open casket service, they have to sometimes break the hand and break the leg in order for it to be straight? How come we don't touch the corpse? Because we believe that there was a soul, and the soul was housed in this body, and therefore you have to treat it with respect. It's very much like the ark. You take out the Sefer Torah from the ark, what are you going to do? You're going to sit down in it? You're going to smoke a cigarette inside? You're going to treat it with a certain dignity. And that's why we treat the corpse with certain dignity. There was once a soul there. However, what better way of treating a corpse than to use it in order to save another soul? Therefore, if you want to know my bottom line, I'd say if a doctor comes and says, I need to do the autopsy for medical knowledge, I'd ask one question. Do you think, in high probability, that by doing this autopsy on this person who just died of a specific sickness that you don't know too much about, you potentially can save a life? If the answer is yes, I'd say it's okay. When is it not okay, just to finish it? It's not okay, first and foremost, for psychological knowledge. Namely, I want to know how my father, my brother, how did he die? That's something that I'm just unfortunate. We don't know how people die, ultimately. But that's not something that does warrant going over these prohibitions. Now, there's not one authority that allows it because of the reasons we said. Secondly, you also can't do an autopsy for what I would call critical knowledge. Namely, to know exactly, for example, to gain evidence on a certain case. The only stipulation I make is by doing that, would you get closer to the killer? Because there is a killer roaming the streets, that could be a potential danger for other Jews and other non-Jews alike. And that's very, very important. And I'll just end by saying, before I take your question, Jack, that there was once, I would say, there was a very interesting proposal said by a certain rabbi, and that was that, look, we're the only religion that has this prohibition of autopsies, correct? So, when you need to do an autopsy, do it on a non-Jew. Don't touch a Jewish body. I personally am not comfortable with that. The reason I'm not comfortable with that is that it's one place in the world in which we're all equal. That is the hospital. A body's a body. When the body comes in and they don't ask, are you Jewish? Oh, you're Jewish, you better take out that textbook. Go over the Jewish body. Oh, you're not Jewish, I better take out the textbook. Go over that body. We're all equal in the hospitals. And my proof is very simple. Do we violate Shabbos to save a non-Jew? Do we violate Shabbos to save a non-Jew? Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Why? The Torah was given to the Jewish people. How do we violate Shabbos to save a non-Jew? The answer is very simple. When it comes to life, we're all equal. God forbid, you go ahead, you'd be a doctor in the hospital, an attending physician, you come in, you're Jewish? No, let him die. God forbid. How would you like it if it was reversed? Therefore, I don't like that proposal. I'm not comfortable with it. If you allow autopsies nationally, then we allow it. If you don't allow, we don't allow it. But we can't pick and choose and say, listen, if it's a Jewish body, don't do an autopsy. I would say, let's at least in the hospital feel that we're all humans. At least in the hospital, let's all go back to the fact that we're all created by God, and ultimately we're equal. If there's one place in the world that that's true, then it's with regard to our very right to live. And therefore, I'd say, if we allow autopsies in certain cases, I would say you have to allow it, Jews and non-Jews alike. That's my personal position, and therefore I say if a doctor says it, not the family, but a doctor says it, there's definitely room to be lenient. Yes, Jack?
The difference in interpretation, as I've understood in the case, somewhat intermittently, is that it has to do with the sort of causal relationship. In one case, there has to be an imminent benefit for a life, and your opinion is reflective of another body of opinion which says that there's a potential benefit, that it could benefit.
No, I think everybody agrees that there's only a potential benefit because ultimately, even if you do an autopsy, let's say you have two cancer patients. They all have the same cancer, whatever the cancer might be. Cancer of the liver, let's say. So this patient dies. This patient's in the hospital, right? We started the week out with that view, the Noda B'Yehuda. He said, if you have a patient in front of you, you can do an autopsy. However, what's the probability that by doing an autopsy you're going to find out how to cure cancer of the liver? It's always potential. So I'd say even if it's potential throughout the board, that's exactly what we're dealing with.
But if you didn't have another patient with a similar kind of disease, there would be another patient at some point in time in some place.
So that's the controversy. According to the Nol de Behuda, as we pointed out, he'd say you can't do it in that case in which there isn't a patient in front of you. However, according to the Chazon Ish, as I said, he died in the 50s, he seemed to say if it's a common illness, meaning there's a high probability that another patient will come in with the same illness, then ultimately you could. And again, we said this week that that probability should be determined by doctors, meaning not by you and me, but by doctors, meaning doctors know today that on a slant how many people unfortunately are sick with cancer, how many people are unfortunately sick with Alzheimer's, how many people are unfortunately sick with other sicknesses, and ultimately they'd be able to tell you if this is a common or not uncommon illness. And I definitely think you can give faith in the doctors in most cases. I'm not saying all doctors, but in most cases, doctors are in a very strong way dealing with life, and therefore they're straight shooters. They say this particular autopsy will help medical research. My tendency is that's definitely allowed. Once again, however, if it's just I want to know how my relative died, with all the compassion I have, I don't think that allows an autopsy.
But will help is a liberal view because it means will help some people sometime.
Correct. That's where I feel that you can be lenient, but you know, maybe I'm a little biased. I'm also a believer in the fact that a person, if needed, if necessary, should have a donor card at all times. I have a donor card. A halachic donor card. There's certain problems with it that I have a certain halachic donor card. It can't touch my body when I take a turn for the worse unless a religious authority comes by and says he's dead. God forbid they'll start cutting out my heart when I'm still alive. You know, doctors sometimes determine death before Jewish law determines death. That's a very important distinction. So I believe to save a life, you can override these prohibitions to save a life. And from my perspective, it's uncanny to believe that that wouldn't be true. If we violate the Holy Shabbos for it, then taking out an organ from a body would be, in my opinion, at least of equal status, not to mention the fact that Shabbos is far more severe than taking an organ out of a body. Again, my opinion, and I want to end with saying it's my opinion. I believe I am entitled to an opinion on this. On the other end, I also have to say there are other opinions, and we have to respect them. We have to respect them at all times. But I definitely feel that in the world we're living in today, we have a certain responsibility to one another as human beings, and especially in a hospital, especially in the place of medicine, that's all the more true. And therefore, I definitely think that we have to go ahead and, in certain cases, allow autopsies under very strict restrictions, namely, not an all-the-board tendency of doing autopsies anytime, but definitely allowing it in certain cases.